I am J.A. Lovelock, a barrister and an author, but most importantly, a crime junkie. Welcome to my podcast, Behind the Yellow Tape. Stephen Keogh was a police officer with London's Metropolitan Police for 30 years, and over half of that time was spent as a Scotland Yard detective, investigating terrorism and murders. Since his retirement from the force, Stephen has turned his hand to writing about his experience as a detective inspector and what it takes to catch killers and bring them to justice. So, in your career, you must have seen or investigated quite a lot of murders. Have you any idea how many?
I don't. I did it for 12 years investigating murders. I didn't do it for all my 30 years. And some murders are... You basically take control of, it's your teams, and then it might be, especially when I was a sergeant, when I was a DS on it, you perform a role called known as a case officer, and it's you that takes it to court. So those kinds of murders I knew inside out, and I was very much a part of. But then you'd also be involved in others where you didn't have that quite such a central role. And then there'd be others where you're assisted in other teams in part of it. So over the 12 years, I couldn't even begin to put a figure on it. I know it's 100 plus, but whether it's 110 or 150 or 190, I don't know. All I know is throughout my career, or throughout those 12 years, we were so it might just be that you're attending the crime scene. Remember what I was talking about earlier about when you first attend a crime scene, but you might then hand that murder investigation onto another team. So I did that a lot, and you kind of lose track of those. I mean, you go to these scenes, and later on, someone will mention it, and you have to really rack your mind about it because you've been to so many. So an awful lot, and I couldn't put a number on it.
But you must have seen an awful lot of dead bodies.
Yeah.
How does that affect you? How does that affect a police officer?
99.9% of the time, it doesn't. If you think about it, so a police officer doesn't just start investigating murders. So when I came out of Hendon, I didn't leave Hendon after 20 weeks and say, right, you're now on a murder team investigating murders. I went to Greenwich, and as a young police officer, what tended to happen then, I don't know if it's the same now, probably not, but what tended to happen then was any calls, it was called sudden death. So that's the term that police use for deaths reported to the police. So it'd be a sudden death, and you'd send the new police officer there, like the new probationer. So I was always getting sent to dead bodies. So you start to build up a resilience. So the first ones you see tend to just be people that have died of natural causes, so they're not very gruesome. And then you might start to go to road traffic accidents or people hit by trains and that kind of, so things kind of, you, so what you're essentially doing is you're building up your resilience bit by bit. So then by the time you do start to do the more serious things, the dead body part of it isn't even part of it. It's not even part of your thinking. You're getting on with your job. You're not thinking about the dead body. So I think the worst scene I ever dealt with was 2005. I was on the anti-terrorist branch, and we were on call, and it was the 7/7 bombings. And my colleague and I, we were the first two from the anti-terrorist branch to turn up to one of the crime scenes, Edgware Road. And we didn't leave for 2 weeks. We stayed there for 2 weeks, and it was our job to remove the dead bodies from the trains, and then we had to do a forensic sweep search of the track and the train itself, which took 2 weeks. And that involved taking out everything that was there. And you can imagine a bomb on a packed train. So, but when you're doing that, because you've been through those steps of dealing with the sudden deaths and the road traffic accidents and et cetera, you can professionally do your job without thinking, oh, this is a dead body. You're just doing what needs to be done. And everything you're doing for that victim. And it would be wrong if you were more caught up in your own feelings and your own concerns rather than trying to get justice for this victim and doing what's right for them. But the only proviso to that, the only thing that I never got used to, and that was dealing with children, that I always found that hard. And in a way, I always thought when that to me was comforting, because you do worry, especially after 7/7, where people were asking me, "Are you okay?" Like, friends and family knew what I did, and I was like, and that started to worry me. Like, well, if everybody's asking me, "Am I okay?" and I really am, should I start? Should I be worried?
Yes.
Like, have I lost a part of myself? So I did reflect a lot, and I was like, well, actually, no. I've got a job to do, and I can't be getting caught up in my own emotions because I'm trying to do it for those victims. And you know what I mean? And if I'm having to wipe my eyes and tears because you can't do that. You've just got to get on and do the job.
Yeah.
It was never that easy with children. Like, we're going to the murder scenes where they were, or their postmortems, and that. I always found that hard.
Mm-hmm. So is there a system then within the force that, what I'd call debriefs you then, and so you are able to, because my question would be, how do you keep going back after having that kind of experience? How do you keep going back to the job?
I honestly think it just gets easier, and it comes down to resilience, and it's not, and the word you'd use there was job, and you're doing your job. And that's what you're focused on. Now, this is purely hypothetical, but if I was in my own private life just to keep walking around and just seeing dead bodies, I think maybe it might start affecting me. But because I'm focusing in on doing what I'm there to do, you don't think about it. And I think I'm very much similar to most police officers, and probably most men, really. I compartmentalize and I just lock things away. But when I was writing my book, funny enough, right? So I hadn't really realized something. So when I was investigating murders, I used to have the most violent dreams. Like, I would go to sleep, and in my dreams, I would be killing people, and I would be doing it in the most violent, brutal ways of stabbing, beating, shooting, strangling, you name it.
God, wow.
In my sleep, I was doing it. And I'd wake up and my partner would laugh about it. She'd be like, "Oh, what have you done now?" I'm not shot someone. But I joked about it because I wasn't worried about it, because it's just what your brain, how it works, isn't it? So I'm sticking away all this stuff that I'm seeing in my brain. And you're not in control of your brain when you're asleep, are you? It takes over.
Yeah.
So this is how it manifests at night.
Mm-hmm.
And it was when I was writing my book, and I was sort of reflecting on it, and I realized I don't have those dreams anymore. As soon as I stopped investigating murders, the dreams stopped.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, yeah. So it must just have been how my brain was processing and keeping me going, maybe. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist, but... I don't have those anymore. I can go to sleep now. Do you know, weirdly, when I have a dream now, I tend to dream that I'm a police officer again. Weirdly. Yeah, I don't. So maybe because I'm always writing about being a police officer. So
I'm just wondering, do you wake up in a sweat and think, "Oh my gosh, I'm a police officer again"?
No. I actually quite enjoy my dreams now. So I'm stressing them.
Gosh, that's quite funny. Has there been a time where you've felt scared on the job?
Really? No, because I think adrenaline kind of takes over in scary moments, so you don't scare. You might later on look back and think, "Oh, that was a bit of a close one there." But at the time, you don't. Actually, there was one, right? So this isn't, sort of talking about probationers, so the new police officers that come out. I'd been in for about 3 or 4 years, and I had a probationer working with me, and we got called to used to get called to these quite a lot. It would be a neighbor hadn't been seen for a while, and it was in Cholton in South London, first floor flat. Got there, knocked on the letterbox, no response. Opened it, put my nose in, because if there's a dead body in a flat, you can generally, there's a smell of dead bodies that you learn what it is very quickly. And I couldn't smell anything, and the neighbor come out and said that the windows at the back don't shut very well, and I've got a ladder. If I give you the ladder, you can climb up and have a look and get in. So went around, put the ladder up against the window, and so the probationer. Right, you can go up the ladder. You're the probationer. You can go in first. But the police lowered the height limit. So there is no height limit. And so I was working with a 5'2" man who couldn't get between the ladder and the window. So okay, well, I'll do it then. So I pushed the window open, and on the other side of the window was a dressing table, which I had to push forward to climb in. And as it fell forward, it went onto a bed. So I sort of clambered over the the dresser into the bedroom, through to the front door, opened the door for him. We had a look around. It was nothing. It was dark. The electricity wasn't working. It was nothing. It was dark. Couldn't see anything. But the only place I hadn't searched is where the dresser had fallen onto the bed, just the other side of the bed. So for completeness, I thought I'd better have a look on that side of the bed. So I looked everywhere. And as I stood on the bed, a leg flew up and hit me completely by surprise. And I ran screaming. I literally ran screaming out the front door of the flat. And the fella I was with come after me screaming too. And then he got outside and he was like, why are we screaming? And I said, 'cause there's a dead body in there. But what I'd done then is I'd disturbed it all. So when we went back in, suddenly it was absolutely full of blue bottles.
Oh,
and the smell was something else. Yeah. It was like, whoa. And it turned out this person had died of natural causes, but hadn't been seen for 2 or 3 months and had died and had fallen onto the radiator. So it basically just melted into the carpet, and it was grim. It was really, really grim. But it all settled until I disturbed it.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so that's probably the most scared. So certainly the only time in my career I've screamed.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you've got a new book coming out. Are you able to tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so what this is it's about Jack the Ripper. And it's two things to it, really. So first off is, if Jack the Ripper was to happen now and we had that serial killer in East London, how would we deal with it? What would we do? How would we investigate it? So that's one aspect of it. Then it's also using as a comparison. So this is how we would do it now. How did they do it then? What's the difference? And then I'm applying some modern day methods to answer three questions, really. It's what did he do? Because there is some controversy over which crimes he actually committed. Mm-hmm. Why did he do it? So trying to get into understand why he committed those crimes, and who was he? Who was Jack the Ripper? So that's the book in a nutshell, really. So it's a modern day approach, comparing it to what went on in the past and trying to answer those three questions.
Good, 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 good. Have you ever thought about writing fiction, like crime fiction?
No. Well, I don't know. I could. I don't know. I'm a South London boy from a comprehensive. I don't think I've got the vocabulary.
Oh, you have.
Express myself. I don't know.
You have.
It's been mentioned a couple of times. But
yeah.
You know, in all honesty, Joanna, the thought of writing another book at the moment is like the last thing I want to do. The hard work.
I know. Quite. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about your career, your experience that you'd like to share?
I don't know. I mean, in terms of a career, I thought it was great. I must have done it in a way that was quite positive, because I got two children that have followed me into it.
Oh,
so my daughter's a detective, my son's in uniform.
Oh, right. They thought, well, if Dad can do that, then so can I.
Yeah. But I've always been quite positive about it. And do you know what? At the moment, I actually feel quite sad about where it's at in terms of people's perception of police officers and policing in general. Well, it makes me really quite sad, because it's a profession that I loved, and I know that there are so many people that give so much in terms of, I mean, like for me, I was divorced, and a huge part of that is the police and the job I was doing, and I missed so many social functions, so many bits of my kids' parties, and at the council going to fit. You just give over so much of your life, and then and then it's, you put yourself and in danger, and it's so, and what I'm saying is, I'm not asking for thanks by doing it. What I'm trying to express is that police officers give up an awful lot to do the job, and they do it willingly. And they do it because they've got the right intentions, and it's all about, police generally is about looking after people and the vulnerable and protecting people. That's what it boils down to. It's about protecting people, protecting the community. And everything that they do is just let down by people. And there's no point in even saying anymore it's just a minority. Everyone knows it's a minority, but that minority have done so many horrible things and so many things beyond that you could even imagine a police officer would do, that it's going to take an awful long time to come back from that. And that makes me really sad for the people that are really give their all for a job, and they've been let down, and it just feels like a long road back.
So do you think then it's a matter of time? Because when you started 30 years ago and over the years, I guess things were fine, you would say?
No, well, they're not. No, not at all. No, I mean, if you think about it, so I joined in 91, and we had the, Stephen Lawrence was killed in 93, and we had the inquiry into that. And it was really hard at the time when we were classed as institutionally racist. And I didn't argue with that at the time. I wouldn't argue with it now. But it feels like we're now all these years down the line and the same thing's happening. And I'm not sure. I don't think it is time, because I think if we don't change, or I say we, it's not me anymore, but if the police don't change in what they do, it's just, are we going to have the same inquiry in 20 years' time and the same thing's going to happen? And it needs a change of attitudes. It needs to come from the top. And I think from the outside looking in at what the new commissioner, Mark Rowley, is doing, I think they're going the right way. And I just hope, my job was investigating murders, and you can't solve murders without the help of the public. And as soon as the public start turning on you, they're your witnesses. They're the people ringing in and giving you information. They're the people that you take to court to solve the crime for you. So if you start losing the public, you can't do your job properly. So, something needs to be done, and it needs to be done quickly, because I think people are just getting worn down by it.
Yeah. Have you got any ideas? Well, what are your thoughts of things that need to be done?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the most important thing is it comes down to leadership. And that's not just from Mark Rowley. It's all the way down to all the sergeants and an understanding of what is right and what is wrong. And I've got my partner's in the police. I've got a daughter in the police. I've got a sister in the police. So I see, as a white heterosexual male, I feel like I had a privileged career, because I didn't get any of that. But having now got female relatives and my partner in the police, I get to see aspects that I think, I didn't have to go through that, and that has to change. It shouldn't be everybody should have what I had in my career. I could just go get on and do the job without having to worry that an aspect that I can't change about myself is interfering with that. Do you know what I mean? I was privileged, and that shouldn't be a privilege, should it? It should just be the same for everybody, whether it's down to your sexual orientation, your color,
you're whatever.
because of your sexual orientation. I couldn't say your sex again. Your gender. Your gender. Yeah. It shouldn't affect you and your career in the police, should it? It should be you should be able to do what I was allowed to do. We should just get on and do the job.
Yeah.
And until we reach that point, we need to reach that point quickly, I think. And that comes down to everybody within the police understanding what is right and what is wrong, and that being reinforced by those in charge.
Yes, lovely. Thanks for that, Stephen. One final positive thing you want to say about your experience in the police?
I suppose the most positive thing is I wouldn't change anything about it. And that's, if you do anything in life and when you've come out of it, if you say you wouldn't change anything, then it's probably gone all right, isn't it?
Yeah, lovely. Stephen, thank you for your time. And
thank you for having me, Joanna. It's been a pleasure.
Stephen Keel's first book, The Murder Investigation Team, is available now to buy. And his next book about Jack the Ripper will be published in July. Thanks for listening. I am J.A. Lovelock. Join us again next time and catch up with more episodes at btytpodcast.com, as well as on all podcast platforms.
I'm an American vigilante. I have a question for you. What would you do if someone you cared about was abducted, taken from you? Would you call me? Would you care about how I got them back? Download American Vigilante now.